It was past 7 o'clock and off on the streets of Boston. The town crier shook his bell and cried out, "Little girl lost, little girl lost, 6 years old in a pink dress, white hat, green shoes, little girl lost." He passed the Newfoundland dog lying on a doorstep. The child, using the dog as her pillow, awoke, listened, and called out, "Why, that's me." This was not the first time that Louisa's family feared that she was lost. When she was 2, as her family traveled from Pennsylvania to Boston, crew and passengers of a boat searched for her, wondering if she had fallen overboard and drowned. Instead, they found her happily covered with dog grease from exploring the engine room. Louisa's father, Bronson Alcott, thought that knowledge came from innate ideas with which everyone is born. It was influenced not only by the philosopher Immanuel Kant in this, but by the poet Wordsworth. He was inspired by the poem Intimations of Immortality, which says, "Our birth is but a sleeping and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath elsewhere its setting. Trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, who is our home." After Bronson Alcott published articles about his teaching methods, a Unitarian minister named Samuel J. May invited him to come to Brooklyn, Connecticut to help improve the community school system. It was there that he met the clergyman's sister, Abba May, from Boston. She was considered an old maid at 28. 2 years later, they were married in Boston's King Chapel, the first church to omit the Trinity from its worship after the U.S. War of Independence. Way before Old Man Ludica's new album, Domestic Eccentric, and present-day interest in sensitive fatherhood, Mr. Alcott observed and journaled about his first 3 daughters as they developed. Bronson Alcott's daughter, Louisa, posed a constant challenge to a father who believed that instead of being born in original sin, children were reflections of original glory. Her rambunctious behavior tried every sense of his patience, suggesting creative alternatives and his reluctance to use corporal punishment. She fought almost continuously with her older sister Anne about who should sit in the rocking chair, whose story should be read by father first, blah, blah, blah. When not so noisily involved, she might think it too quiet and pull down the overhanging cloth on a table that was set with tableware and china. Or with a sense of her power as a small youngster, she might declare, "I'll wake the baby." Her father, pursuing a career as a teacher of young children, wrote of the problem in a positive light. Hers is the wild exuberance of a powerful nature. To calm Louisa, she was left at home with her mother while Bronson took Anna to school. Finally, Louisa was sent to her father's school at the age of 3. School at that time was rare and often dismal. Very few children went, and those that did seldom went for long, unless they were from a very wealthy family and were male. After all, it only took a year to learn basic reading and sums. The usual school featured long backless benches and desks. Teachers were paid very little for putting children through their paces, and women were paid 1/2 to 1/4 as much. Often, this reading, writing, and arithmetic were done to the tune of a hickory stick. For discipline was stiff, with switches and the embarrassment of a dunce cap used to instill knowledge into stubborn, misbehaving skulls. It is interesting that about the time that Louisa May Alcott was writing about Amy's punishment with a thick ruler in Little Women, her beloved uncle, Unitarian minister Samuel J. May, was serving as the head of the Board of Education in Syracuse, New York, and abolished corporal punishment with a vote of the teachers. He had been punished unjustly as a youth, and he had been influenced by a Quaker publication on the subject. Unlike the typical classroom of the 1830s, Bronson Alcott liked to conduct classes in large, well-lit rooms. He ordered a chair and desk for every pupil. He made lessons interesting enough to be enjoyed. With legs spread wide apart, he was a living Y. And like this, he was a living X. So, Bronson Alcott was one of the first to realize that it was easier to print before learning script writing. He was also aware that children were learning complexities of coordination and ideas at the same time. He was reluctant to be negatively critical. Instead, he stressed good points and urged more practice. Scholarly women, first Elizabeth Peabody and then Margaret Fuller, who were Unitarians, were learned assistants who assured that their charges knew the basics, while Alcott concentrated on having conversations with the children, gathered in a circle. He liked to draw out their own ideas and shape them. This went well for a first book, but a second touched remotely on sexual education and was made into a scandal by a newspaper relentlessly. Several children were withdrawn. When a black child was admitted, the rest left. The advent of a monetary downturn at this time did not promote adventures in thinking. After the school closed, Bronson Alcott suffered a breakdown. Reverend May invited the family to come to his new church home in South Scituate, Massachusetts. There, Louisa enjoyed the sea, watching gulls, finding seashells, driftwood, and other riches. She made up stories about where the glass she found came from. More practically, she was learning to sew, to hem, to darn, to tap, and to embroider. Uncle May's family enjoyed singing ballads and telling ghost stories that were full of deserted inns, howling winds, clanking chains, and creaking doors. The children invented scenarios. They were vegetable sellers, stagecoach travelers, beggars, or kings and queens at a ball, or what is it? She liked using her sword. Asked for help with costuming, Louisa's mother took the girls to the trunk of Aunt Dolly Q. The children made good use of the old finery of the former First Lady of Massachusetts. Her husband was John Hancock. U.S. citizens know him as the first person to sign the Declaration of Independence with a huge signature. So her finery was gloves, dresses, shawls, and wonderful old-fashioned shoes. Persuaded by Ralph Waldo Emerson, who had found Bronson Alcott's comments and inspiration while he wrote his early essays, the family moved to Concord, Massachusetts. On November 29, 1839, Louisa found presents beside her bed. It was a painting. cushion, books, and a new doll in a pink calico dress and sunbonnet. Her mother wrote, "My dear little girl, will you accept this doll from me on your 7th birthday? She will be a quiet playmate for my active Louisa. Be a kind mother and love her for my sake." This may have been near the time that Louisa looked at a drawing of her hand and resolved that it should act good instead of bad, more like her mother's hardworking and kind hands. The journal that her parents had given her was regularly read by them and included their notes to her. Partly in frustration at Louisa's continuing bad behavior, Abba started writing daily notes to her children, which she put in what she called the budget basket. Certainly, the children in this family had no fear of leading an unexamined life. The 7th year was also important since Louisa took walks in the woods with other children, led by the young man, Henry David Thoreau. Later, she wrote a poem about his flute playing, which many people thought was by Emerson. To be thought well of by boys, she jumped from a high beam and broke her ankles, both of them. She also rubbed a dried red pepper into her eyes when she was dared. Getting older didn't seem to solve everything, for she went for a joyride with someone else's horse and buggy. The doll hats she made and sold were discovered to have plumes that were plucked off as she chased neighbors' chickens. At the age of 10, Louisa experienced what it was like to live in a utopian community. Her father had been written to by some Englishmen, so impressed by his writings on education that they had founded a school named Alcott House, to which they invited him. He went off to England in 1842 and enjoyed being a sought-after philosopher. After 6 months, he returned in the company of Charles Lane and his son William, who was Louisa's age. Mr. Lane chose a farm property distant from the influence of Emerson to begin a vegetarian community named Fruitlands near Harvard, Massachusetts. Everyone wore a loose tunic and pants made of linen. That's the men and the women. He avoided animal products and ate raw vegetables. Bronson was influenced by a lecture of Sylvester Graham. They're all graham crackers for our coffee hour. The only remnant of his system. So they might eat oatmeal pudding, apples, coarse whole wheat, bread, nuts, and of course, pure fountain water. There were also potatoes sent in a barrel from Uncle May for one of the day's two meals. In season, there were blackberries and raspberries. Once, when a visitor inquired if there were any beasts of burden, Louisa's mother snapped something like, "Just a woman." Since she was busy with tasks of cleaning, meals, clothes washing, and the men had gone off philosophizing, funding, and recruiting journeys. In Louisa's later story, Transcendental Wild Oats, the mother and children rescue barley before the ravages of a storm. This probably happened. Tired of her burdensome family situation and the the children experienced tension at this point in time because they overheard their parents talking about separating. So, tired of the burdensome family situation and the pressure towards celibacy that Lane exerted on Bronson, Abigail decided to move. She made other arrangements and she took all the furniture with her. Thus, Fruitlands closed in January 1844. Louisa's increase in willingness to help was important. When Abba May accepted a position in Boston, assisting the poor in a systematic way. The Bronson family shared portions of their resources when others did not have enough fuel or food. Not only was Abba one of the first to professionally dispense charity, but she was an increasingly critical theorist as well. Searching for causes of the desperation she saw around her, she crisply questioned why there was so much unemployment and why workers were so underpaid. She declared, "Incompetent wages for labor performed is the cruel tyranny of capitalist power over the laborer's necessities." She pointed out that society in general paid the costs of such practices with a high rate of crime and despair. Louisa worked for many hours a day then, perhaps as many as 14, writing stories when she wasn't sewing or teaching in Concord or Boston for an income. She looked through her mother's journals, which were full of depression and idealism, for story ideas. Louisa had been writing poems and plays since she was 8. She worked at writing not only for creative satisfaction, but for the improvement to her family life that selling stories would give. For a story, she could get just $10, or she could get $50 or $75. You know? So this was pretty important. She won $100 in a contest for the best Blood and Thunder tale. It was avoiding all the appearance of scandal, but allowed incidents to suggest more than they actually were to heighten the drama. The plot was as psychological as those by her neighbor Nathaniel Hawthorne or even Edgar Allan Poe. Usually appearing without her real name, her stories posed moral dilemmas. Is a governess who seems refined, but is really a poor and scheming actress, who manages to be attentive to all around her. Is she really a wicked woman when she marries the aging head of a rich household? How does an unforgiving vendetta mark the character and life of a perpetrator? To a great extent, many early stories not only follow popular formulas, but are veiled comments on the dependent and economically vulnerable role of most women. Her tales were indirect expressions of some of their deepest yearnings for acknowledgement and success, for romance and relationship. Louisa wrote under pseudonyms because she regarded these tales as sensational and lurid romantic rubbish. She wrote, "How should I dare to interfere with the proper grayness of old Concord? The dear old town has never known a startling hue since the redcoats were here." Not content to sew shirts or prepare bandages for soldiers, when the Civil War was being fought in the United States, Louisa was a nurse in Washington, D.C. She saw much wounding. She saw many deaths. She saw many amputations. She knew war was dreadful. She was there only a month before her father had to come and get her and to bring her home because she was so sick. Out of this experience of seeing and comforting wounded and dying men, she wrote the book Hospital Sketches, which became her first bestseller. it made her a writer in demand by publishers. After her stories began to be regularly published, Louisa developed a pattern of living during the winter in Boston and during the summer in Concord. A descendant of the Mays, Eve LaPlante writes in her book, Marmee and Louisa, at the end of 1852, Louisa joined 2,000 others at the Music Hall in Boston to hear radical minister Theodore Parker lecture to laborious young women. Parker's prayer, she told her mother, was unlike any I had ever heard. It was not cold and formal, as if uttered from a sense of duty, not a display of eloquence, nor an impious directing of deity in its duties toward humanity. It sounded instead like a quiet talk with God. His phrase, our mother, father, God, sounded impressively sweet and beautiful, seeming to invoke of power and love to sustain the anxious and overburdened hearts of those who listened. They went away to labor with fresh hope and faith, she thought. On Sunday nights, Louisa went to receptions at Parker's home, where she saw and listened to the old abolitionists and to others, including scholars, just in town for that time. During her adult life, Louisa submitted many petitions signed by the people she knew and others she met, urging that women gain the right to vote. They were rejected. She was disappointed that few women took advantage of the right to vote in school board elections. She also raised the child left when her artist sister died. The child was named Lulu. Many people are at a loss to explain why Louisa May Alcott's family-oriented writings continue to be read and published. I have some ideas. Louisa May Alcott presents us not only with writing that anticipated naturalism by a couple of decades, but she was attuned to the debates of our commercial society. She showed that richness does not always mean happiness, that poverty is not always determinatively grinding. But she did not defend our own proclivities or systems as they are. She sketched lives which are self-questioning and could be aware of the implications of their actions. She believed that in the caring community, positive change was possible. She seems to echo her mother's work world sentiments. I cannot pass by. I must whisper a word of encouragement or hope to them, although I feel a sinking sadness tugging at my anchor. Their lifeboat is drifting. A small rope may save it. Though through it in mercy, all may yet go safely. Her own motto was, do what is nearest. Another significant contribution of Louisa May Alcott is her presentation of a physically vigorous lifestyle for girls to balance the overly delicate norm that was then current. She also showed us the importance of vigorous but sensitive boys and men to balance the uncaring selfishness encouraged by society. Louisa mainstreamed these ideas, which still were the isolated experience of a few daring reformers and enlightened parents like Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Louisa believed that hard work by both girls and boys, women and men, in all areas and professions of life were necessary to develop a sense of personal and societal well-being. To be of use is both the greatest need and the greatest reward for each. Last but not least, I'd like to point out that Louisa May Alcott presented deeply rooted values which are often seen as religious without stuffing them into a prefabricated orthodox mold that has only specific rituals and a particular language as redeeming. People in her stories blossom in attentiveness to the best of their own inner promptings, the nurture and caring of family and extended friends, and the reassuring and inspiring rhythms and sights of nature. As the song says, there is a tenderness in living that makes it all worthwhile. It is in the gentleness of giving that keeps us from going wild.